What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Pilch. Today I'm joined by Mark Schleifer, Regional Director of Europe, Eurasia, South Asia at the Center for International Private Enterprise. Mark, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
What's the world looking like to you right now?
Well, you know, I should start by saying that, you know, I should be surprised, but maybe not surprised about how the election turned out. You know, hindsight is always 20/20, but I think a lot of the signs were there, and maybe some of us, particularly here in D.C., weren't really paying attention to what those signs were. But I think, you know, that the world is headed towards increasing polarization, and that's going to generate opportunities for conflict that are going to have to be very carefully managed. And I do think that conflict is very likely. I should say, before I, you know, get too far into this, just a word or two about my organization, about CIPE, the Center for International Private Enterprise. We are a nonprofit affiliate of, though not funded by, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and we are one of the four core institutes of the congressionally funded National Endowment for Democracy. And we also get some funding from other USG sources, from State Department, from USAID. So as a general rule, we don't comment on U.S. domestic policy and U.S. domestic politics. Obviously I have to be, you know, a little bit judicious in what I say in that respect. But our organization works at the intersection of economic development and democratic development all around the world. As you mentioned, I cover Europe, Eurasia, and South Asia. So that gives me a perspective of, looking at trends in various corners of the globe. And it's really from that that I draw my conclusions. We are, I think, headed towards a period where, well, let's just say, you know, history is back in a big way. And I think that those trends are only going to be exacerbated.
So I think a lot of people agree with you and have kind of said similar things, right? Like, history is repeating itself. But in your mind, what is it like? What do you mean by that? Because I think a lot of people mean a lot of different things by that. But what does it look like to you?
I think that systems and institutions that we've relied on to maintain global economic and diplomatic and democratic order over the past 70 years have slowly eroded, and they've not just eroded, they've eroded in a really interesting kind of way. The metaphor that I kind of think of is almost with, you know, they talk about this with, you know, animal control, that if you get rid of all the predators of a certain species, then that species multiplies, and then it eats too much of the grass, and then that species dies out, you know. Or if you, you know, put too much of, you put too much of, you put too much of, a bacteria in a petri dish and it eats all the food, then the colony collapses. I think what we have is a number of systems that we've relied on to maintain order that have maybe performed in a way so well that they are now turning in on themselves. And I think I've been spending, a lot of time recently thinking about various kinds of systems and institutions that had the seeds of their own destruction embedded within them, and that we weren't really paying attention to it. And, you know, that's where I think the opportunities are going to arise for conflict, because it's not clear to me at all what the, you know, when I say history is going to repeat itself, I think that, you know, or history being back, I think that we're going to have to come up with new ways of ordering and organizing, you know, human relations on the planet.
So what are some of the systems that you kind of see as eating themselves?
Well, all right. So one of the big sort of triumphs, I think, of the post-World War II kind of consciousness is that, you know, if people are in need, we have to, you know, if we are Western liberal democracies, we have to welcome them, and we have to shelter refugees who are fleeing from conflict, because, we know what happened when the world made that mistake, in the 30s and 40s. And so, you know, now we have, and, you know, and I think, you know, Merkel in Germany was a very unique sort of illustration of this, that we have to sort of welcome those who are seeking refuge from conflict. And the problem with that is twofold. First of all, I think that if you welcome a lot of populations who don't necessarily share the values of the country to which they are coming, then you get a lot of people on the left and the right questioning whether or not, you know, this country still, you know, which whether it's here in the U.S. or in Europe, whether this country still sort of represents the same kind of liberal values that we, you know, that led us to accept all of these folks in the first place, right? I mean, you know, you get this sort of overarching question of, you know, if we accept everyone, do we accept those who reject the values that we hold dear, things like, you know, things like women's, you know, place in society, or questions of, you know, religious freedom, and, you know, questions of separation of church and state, you know, those are going to naturally arise, right? I mean, mm-hmm. if you accept everyone, do you accept the people who basically wouldn't
want to be here if circumstances were different?
Precisely. So that's the first problem. And then the second problem is you're naturally going to create a backlash against it, right?
Sure.
So, you know, I think one lesson of the election here in the U.S. and, you know, looking at, you know, we had sort of, you could might say, a near miss in Austria, and we just had this referendum in Italy, which was sort of, though everything that Renzi wanted to do wasn't on the ballot, I think, you know, because Renzi promised to step down if he lost, I think in a sense you can say it was a referendum on Renzi,
right?
And he lost. And I think, you know, there's a lot of those same kind of popular frustrations that were embedded in the no vote in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, folks are saying, wait a minute, why are we welcoming into our country a lot of people who don't share our values? And you know, I think there's this sense that, well, we're not taken care of. You know, our living standards have declined. We don't have jobs. So that same kind of liberalness and openness that drove us to say, hey, our doors are open, we will protect all, has now created the backlash that is generating the rise of populism and xenophobia, you know, across the West.
So I think there are some obvious kind of dangers, right, to populism and xenophobia. But thinking about the regions that you focus in specifically, what kind of challenges do you kind of anticipate as a result of these feelings? And I say feelings because, sure, there's some logic involved, but where the logic leads is a bit extreme.
So I think the number one challenge is to moderate the extreme tendencies that are embedded in that logic, right? And so I'm having a very interesting back and forth, mostly over text message, with a very good friend of mine who thinks about this kind of stuff a lot. And, you know, basically what he is helping me to think about, in deference to him, you know, is this notion of what is a liberal nationalism.
Hmm.
And I think Merkel's speech, where she laid out, I mean, I think the number one story that the press ran with is that, you know, we're going to ban the burqa in Germany.
Yeah.
But there were other elements to that speech as well, including a recognition that, well, you know, we can't let a million something refugees into Germany every single year. You know, now you've seen Merkel kind of, I mean, she's an extremely astute politician. I mean, you've seen her sort of pivot back, you know, and she's talking about potentially, you know, we need to look at even, you know, deporting back some of the refugees who have come to Germany. I think the challenge is, how do you carve out a nationalism that doesn't tip over into illiberal nationalism, right?
Sure.
And how do you say, okay, you know, and I think you've seen some of the Scandinavian leaders wrestle with this as well, you know, how do you have a sort of, you know, robust kind of definition of, like, you know, this is who we are, this is what we stand for. Our doors are open if you accept our values, if you, you know, want to live according to the way that we, right, you know, have decided.
If you want to be friends with everybody here and welcome everyone, then you can be in our club. But right, if you don't want to welcome everyone, you can't, we won't you.
That's right. And I think, you know, it's very interesting. I mean, immigration is very interesting. And again, you know, this, you know, friend of mine who's, you know, noted to me, you know, we've, you know, I think we romanticize immigration here in the U.S. with good reason, right? When we are, you know, although I always cringe a little bit when I hear that, oh, you know, we're a nation of immigrants. Let's not forget that we're also a nation of descendants of slaves.
Right.
And we're also, you know, there's a lot of other sort of elements to that, right? But, you know, we like to think of ourselves as a nation of immigrants, right? But, you know, even during the golden age of immigration here, as has been pointed out, we had quotas on immigrants. We had an extremely strict immigration system. That's first of all. Second of all, I think, you know, that this notion of the melting pot, which, you know, another one of these systems that has, you know, contained the seeds of its own destruction. The notion of multiculturalism is a really interesting one for me, you know. The notion of multiculturalism and the creation of the melting pot, which slowly evolved into the mixing bowl or the salad bowl, whatever they like to call it, where, you know, we said, okay, well, you know, sort of we're going to appreciate and tolerate all values, you know, has created tensions in society, right? I mean, you know, we, again, back to the sort of question of immigration, do we accept those whose values are in conflict with the values that led us to accept them in the first place? And so I think that, you know, in answer to your question, how we deal with this, I think that one of the challenges of how, you know, one of the things that we're going to have to grapple with is going back maybe to the melting pot and go away from the mixing bowl, the salad bowl.
Because not everybody wants cheese in their salad.
Exactly, exactly.
So one thing that always strikes me as, I don't know, strange or disheartening, I haven't quite decided, is that when we talk about immigration, whether it's to the United States or what's going on in Germany and other places, we talk about deportation or whatever else, and it takes us longer to get to the conversation about why people left in the first place, why they left Syria or Yemen or Ethiopia or Mali or wherever else, or Russia. And in my mind, there's some danger to that, right? Because it doesn't really matter in some ways what a given country's policy is to immigrants, refugees, those seeking asylum, because that doesn't solve the problem, right? It doesn't get to the root cause. And do you think that what we see with these systems in conflict and eating themselves is going to pull us further away from taking a step back and saying, we are reacting to something else? You know, like our reaction about immigration is the result of conflict elsewhere. Are we going to get further away from that?
Right. I think there's something to that. You know, I think, you know, people are always reacting to something, and they're often reacting to the wrong thing. I don't know how you get around that, though. I would have to think about that a little bit more.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, as far as I understand it, and you know, and I'm not an expert on migration and you know, on refugee issues. Although I did have the chance a couple weeks back to attend a fabulous conference run by a Dutch organization called Spark that thinks about these kind of things a lot, and they think about the intersection of immigration and refugees and economic issues and economic development in conflict-affected areas. So
it's on your mind.
Right. So it's on my mind a little bit, right? So as far as I understand it, there's basically three root causes that are driving the migration issue right now. One, obviously, is conflict in Syria and Afghanistan. There's a tremendous amount of economic migration, obviously, people looking for better economic opportunities for themselves and for their children in Western Europe. and then the final reason, is, as I understand it, is environmental. I mean, there's a lot of people, and this that is something that's only going to accelerate. You know, people who are, you know, going away from where the land is arid and there's no, you know, water, and you know, there's, you can't farm the land, and so they're leaving for, and a lot of that is internal migration. I mean, we, you know, I think we forget about that, right? I mean, the phenomenon of people right, flooding into the cities in developing world countries. So, yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, you're always sort of fighting the last thing, right? So, I mean, and I think, you know, in particular right now, the political culture that's evolved in most of the West at this point is going to make it really hard for us to tackle what those root causes are. You know, I think you're really on to something there. And I would say, you know, specifically, you know, going back to sort of this theme that's on my mind, the economic side is a really interesting piece that I think about a lot, right? I mean, like, globalization is another one of these, you know, wonderful things that, you know, I think is becoming apparent, again, contains the seeds of its own destruction. When you increasingly push the notion of globalized capital and then globalized labor, and a globalized sort of flow of intellectual property and brands, you know, moving around the world, and you know, and it's not just about cheap labor. I mean, there's, you know, there's other issues as well, you know, that would drive a company to locate its production in one place or another. You know, let's not forget that globalization has lifted millions upon millions of people out of absolute poverty, right? You know, people who are living in so-called developing countries are doing much better now than they were 20 or 30 years ago. That's a fact, right? I mean, you know, on across a range of indicators on maternal health and literacy and, you know, nutrition and, you know, just sort of baseline numbers about number of people living under a dollar a day, you know, the world by and large is doing better. But the problem with that is that then drives a reaction in the countries that have been the drivers of globalization in the first place, where large numbers of voters look around and they say, well, wait a minute, you know, I don't care that folks in Bangladesh are doing better. I don't care that folks in Pakistan are doing better. I feel like, relatively speaking, I'm doing worse. And, you know, it's really difficult, I think, as politicians have learned here in the U.S. and in other countries as well, to point to overall gains in the fact that, you know, your goods are much cheaper and phones are cheaper and computers are cheaper. When you have, you know, pockets, you can point to, here's a factory that closed and here's 1,000 people who lost their job. That's, you know, that's real political power, right? I mean, you know, the diffuse gains spread across millions are totally outweighed by the very vocal pockets of people. And these are real losses, right? I don't mean to, you know, minimize that at all, but you know, those people are feeling economic pain, right? So relatively speaking, they feel worse off. They don't really care that folks in, you know, as I say, Bangladesh are doing better. And now they're making electoral choices to elect leaders who are going to now potentially drive a backlash against that same system of economic globalization that, you know, that sort of kicked off this whole process, right? So, you know, I mean, that, you know, that's what I say, you know, globalization has created the conditions for people now to vote against globalization.
You know, I think status anxiety gets in the way of people caring about Pareto optimality, right? Like, we do not care that overall everyone is better. If you are doing slightly worse, so someone else can do even better. But that's a whole other podcast. So,
that is. And I know you're really interested in the you know, yeah, I mean, right. I mean, sort of as a human race, we're not optimizing happiness.
Right.
And we don't make our electoral choices that way.
Right? So on this idea of, kind of, right, optimizing happiness and this conflict, do you see in the areas you work in, Europe, Eurasia, and South Asia, do you see or anticipate seeing it manifesting in different ways because of the other systems in place in those regions?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, you're talking about three very different kinds of places, right? Obviously, I mean, you know, Europe, you know, I mean, I think we talked a little bit about right. Europe and the U.S. and sort of the malaise of the West. You know, Eurasia is still, you know, I mean, a lot, you know, you look at Central Asia, you look at, you know, I mean, it's, you know, you've got a different picture. I think, you know, I was in Ukraine not long after the U.S. election. I can tell you that folks in Ukraine are very worried about the outcome of the election.
Interesting.
They're very worried about, you know, the U.S. security commitment. I was in Europe meeting with some folks at NATO after the election. There's some worry there.
Sure.
You know, I think that if I were sitting in Bosnia right now, I might be a little concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, let's see what happens. Let's see what happens, for example, with, you know, snap elections that are, well, they were supposed to be snap elections. They've been delayed repeatedly in Macedonia. But, you know, this sort of trend of you know, voters wanting, you know, a messianic leader to, you know, to rescue them, right?
Sure.
I mean, the dominant force in the world right now, you know, looks like the kind of leaders like Putin and Xi. You know, those are the, you know, that is sort of the model, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I think, you know, I heard this mentioned at a conference the other day. You know, people, for some reason, seem to be turning to people who they perceive as strong men.
Right.
And the fact that, you know, the Chinese economy is actually suffering, and the fact that, you know, Russian standard of living is actually quite poor and that the Russian economy is not actually doing very well doesn't really seem to affect how people are actually, you know, how people are actually, you know, making their choices from a political point of view. You know, I think that, you know, the economic, I mean, you know, we maybe have made that mistake in assuming that it's economic factors that drive how people vote. And I think we have to grapple with the fact that, you know, maybe these notions of identity and national glory and national greatness that motivate, you know, things that come out of Moscow and Beijing are why people are making their choices. So, you know, I don't see very much hope for change in Eurasia.
Mm-hmm.
Going to South Asia, you know, that's an interesting one, right? Because, I mean, the trend in South Asia, well, with the exception of the ongoing conflict in Afghanistan, which doesn't appear to be getting much better, but by and large, the trend in South Asia has been towards greater democratization. And South Asia is still very much, I would say, both on the democratic side and on the economic side, still very much a rising place, right? There's still, I think, a lot of popular optimism there. I think it'll be very interesting to see how the new administration here in the U.S. engages in South Asia. You know, I can tell you from talking to Pakistan watchers that the supposed phone call between President-elect Trump and Nawaz Sharif was very widely covered in Pakistan, very heavily debated, and raised some eyebrows in Delhi.
Sure.
Right, because there was, you know, some people in, you know, Islamabad read into this an implicit promise that the U.S. would get engaged in helping Pakistan resolve the Kashmir issue. That's at least how the text was read in Islamabad. So, you know, I think, you know, and you're dealing also with very strong national leaders. I mean, Nawaz Sharif is a business person.
Sure.
You know, the you know, mechanics of the Pakistani state and governance is much weaker there. And on the flip side, then you have Modi, who's a very strong national leader and has a lot of support from his population and has certainly sort of strummed the populist strings when he needs. So I would worry about South Asia as well. You know, you've got two nuclear armed powers who are, you know, going to do their best to court the new administration, and you might see interests coming to odds there.
So, Mark, this whole podcast has very much been, you know, what's next? What is the world looking like to you in the future? And, of course, that's always our last question, so I'm going to tweak it a little bit and say, if these systems do eat themselves to sort of any degree, what do you think the world is going to look like?
Well, I think that we are facing really existential challenges to the question of what is democracy, right? I mean, democracy is another one of these systems that, you know, it produces unregulated, it produces populism. And populism then, you know, has a tendency to undercut one of the core values of democracy, which is that the minority gets a say. So, you know, unfettered democracy produces populism, which leads to what I heard once described as communal majoritarianism. I think this notion that we anticipated that, you know, we had the ever freer exchange and free flow of information, and that everybody could be an expert and everybody could be a blogger and a video sure. blogger and a tweeter
and a podcaster,
you know, and that with Twitter and Facebook, everybody would be making the news. And then the information would be more democratized has led us to now distrust the media in mm-hmm. a way that, you know, the media used to be sort of the gatekeepers. They verified facts. They checked things. We had trained reporters who went out and gathered information and presented that information, and then people would make decisions based on verifiable information. Now with this tremendous proliferation of information, it actually undercuts the whole notion of the free flow of information, because information then becomes sort of almost kind of meaningless in a sense. It's people kind of then create their own realities and function within them. Even to an extent, you know, capitalism unfettered, and I'm a capitalist, you know, I'm not a socialist, you know, but capitalism unfettered, you know, creates, you know, if you have populist leaders in place in the West and other parts of the world as well, potentially, who chip away at some of the safeguards that we've relied on to regulate our capitalist system, then you see the rise either of cronyistic companies, state-controlled companies. You know, you get a proliferation of corruption, you get monopolies, and then monopolies then dwarf the ability of smaller, more innovative firms to even break into the market in the first place. Then you get, you know, people, you know, clamoring for more protection, more limitations on trade. And, I think that's another one of these sort of systemic issues. So I think that, you know, again, going back to that theme that I started with, you know, these ideas that have underpinned our entire architecture for 70 years are really very much at risk. Democracy is at risk. The notion of, you know, of markets and capitalism is very much at risk. I think what's next in that sense, you know, and building on this notion of short term, at least the potential risk for conflict, I think what's next is, you know, potentially a reordering of both domestic and international political order, where you might see, a real rise globally of for lack of a better word, let's call it sort of, you know, non-democratic systems. And that, I think, is one of the biggest fears, one of the biggest worries that I have, and something that I think that people across the political spectrum and across different geographies who think about these things should be worried about and should be, you know, trying to come up with responses to.
Well, Mark Schleifer, Regional Director of Europe, Eurasia, and South Asia at CIPE, the Center for International Private Enterprise. Hopefully none of those things will happen. But if they do, you will be back to talk about it on yet another podcast, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure. Really appreciate it.
This has been What's Next from American Security Project. I'm Maggie Feldman-Filch.